Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Did you like looking at maps when you were a kid? I remember my parents had a map of the United States, and it was through that, I think I was probably in the third or the fourth grade, when I learned all the state capitals. And I would just look at that map all day and just try to learn that. And then eventually graduating from that to a world map. And of course, this is before you had internet, before you had YouTube or ways to really see a lot of the world. Sometimes just looking at a map was the way to explore and think about all of these distant, faraway places, natural features. I loved looking at it. And even if you didn't love maps as a kid, I'm hoping what I'll share with you in today's Free for All Friday episode of the Council of Trent podcast will help you appreciate maps better and how important they are to our lives. Imagine if you didn't have maps. I remember when we would drive around with our family before you had GPS, we had the big atlas. When you go on a road trip, it was a map folded into a big book and we'd flip through the atlas to find our way or where we were going. And then when you had internet, before you had smartphones, you wanted to get somewhere, you would go to MapQuest and you would print off the map and carry it with you and you're going to read and go do things. And now today I have to do that if I don't have really good data on my phone or something like that. But imagine if you didn't have a map. Imagine a world without maps. You just had directions from people and you had to get there in that way. Our ability to travel and understand and see the world would be severely inhibited. So what I want to share with you today is the fascinating world of maps and all the things about them you may not have thought about. So let's get right to the outset. The maps that you look at are probably lying to you in one way or another. First, if it's a map of the entire world, unless it is a globe, it is lying to you. Now, lying, of course, is a harsh word. The people who make maps, the good people at Rand McNally, are not out to deceive you and pull the wool over your eyes. But it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that map makers or cartographers, the field of cartography, the creation of maps, have been struggling with ever since they tried to first create realistic maps of the world. And here's the problem. You take a globe, and you can do this at home. It's a fun experiment with kids or with other people. Take a balloon, just blow up a balloon, and try drawing a map of the world on it. So you got, you know, North America, that big landmass there, and you try to draw all of it around the balloon as best you can. All right, then pop the balloon and then try to reconfigure the pieces of the balloon to make a flat representation of the image on the balloon. Now, you can try to do that, but you end up squishing and pulling things. And when you do that, it becomes distorted. And that's the perennial problem of trying to take a three-dimensional sphere and transpose the information on it, the location, to show not only just the size of where things are, their relative location from one another, trying to transpose that from a three-dimensional surface to a two-dimensional surface. You can't do that without without some kind of distortion coming into play. That's why a few years ago, Google Earth actually changed their programming on your desktop that when you zoom out far enough, you can actually see the Earth as a globe on your computer monitor, how it's arranged. And I was thrilled that Google went and did that. Yes, I have low expectations for things that thrill me in life nowadays. Google has a globe now. It's actually represented correctly. So if you, I mean, look at a map, and odds are if you look at a map in a classroom, or in on your phone, or anywhere you look at most maps, there are different projections. You go to Wikipedia, and there are different philosophies about how to take the location, everything on a three-dimensional sphere, the Earth. It's a spheroid, not a sphere. We're kind of look more like a, it's closer to more like an egg almost than a perfect sphere, where the Earth is a spheroid. But regardless, how do you take that and put it onto a flat map? Go to Wikipedia, look up map projections. There's got to be 24 of them there. I used to think there were only like maybe a handful, and there's a handful of projections that people regularly use, but there are lots and lots of different projections of people thinking, how do I represent the Earth in a way that is accurate on a two-dimensional plane? The most common projection that you will come across is the Mercator projection, or the Mercator projection, developed by Gerardus Mercator in 1569. So it's your typical square rectangular map. And then you look at, and you would think when you first look at it, oh, okay, yeah, that's the Earth. And it's a great kind of map because it always orients north. It's good at representing things around the equator, and it keeps ratios between distances and things like that fair, you know, even. So it was a good map for mariners, for people who are traveling by sea who need to plot a course and go in a straight line, the Mercator projection could get them there accurately. But the problem is with the Mercator projection. When you look at a regular map, and this is probably the projection you look at in a classroom, or you look up map of the world, it's the first thing that's going to come up, probably the most popular one, is that the size of the continents are distorted the further you get away from the equator. Now, why is it? Well, why are they distorted? Well, there's different philosophies about how to transpose the information on a sphere into a flat plane. So what the Mercator projection does, imagine you're holding the Earth in your hands. So put your hands out like a bowl, and you're holding the Earth in your hands. You see this sphere. Now imagine you could put a cylindrical tube around the sphere. So just imagine like how you put a tennis ball into a tennis ball can. Imagine that tennis ball is the Earth, and you put it into the can, and the cylinder goes all the way around it. What you would do then is you would draw a line from every point on the tennis ball, and every point on the tennis ball, as the line goes up, it will hit one of the sides of the cylinder. So imagine you're doing that. You got the tennis ball in the tennis tube can, and the lines extend out directly away from the tennis ball. They'll hit the sides of the cylinder. So what happens? You hit all those points, and then you unroll the cylinder, and you would get the map. And so that's called a cylindrical projection. And so it works well, as you can imagine, it works well at the equator because it's just line for line. There's no angle to distort it. So everything you see around the equator is pretty the correct size if you use a cylindrical projection. But the further you get away from the equator, the less able you are to accurately represent the size of different continents and land masses. So as you're going further up, so you get to the very tippy top of the tennis ball and it points up the North Pole, you have to kind of use more of a guesstimation there. You can't actually include that in the map because the top of the tennis ball does not hit any of the sides of the cylinder. You can't represent it. Now, there's different kinds of projections that actually, instead of using a cylinder, in order to get the top of the world, you would place your tennis ball inside of a cone instead of a cylinder, a cone. And as it goes out, that's called a conal projection. And these kinds of projections you see in like the United Nations seal, like the seal for the United Nations is sort of like a flat representation of the Earth. Or imagine you make a map of the Earth. Instead of a map where it's like you're out in space looking at it from the equator, what would the Earth look like if you were out in space and you looked at it from the North Pole directly beneath you? It's not really beneath in space, but you get the idea. And so these conical projections have the North Pole at the center. And you see these in, I think that's a symbol that's used in like old Cold War treaties and United Nations maps use the conical projection. But they're not as helpful for travel or things like that. Well, actually, I believe some conical projections, they keep east and west from being distorted. So they are really good for pilots. But for the rest of us, we're just trying to understand how the Earth looks. A Mercator projection works a lot better. But remember, it gets distorted as you get further away. So that's why if you look at a map, here's a question for you. Africa is bigger than Greenland. It is. Now, when you look at a map, imagine that Mercator projection. You can bring it up on your computer now, or you can just imagine a map. Imagine the world. You see it in front of you. You see North America. There's a big white landmass to the right of it, Greenland. Now, look over at Africa. In your mind, or if you're looking at a Mercator projection, how much bigger is Africa than Greenland? You might be saying, maybe it's like just 50% larger, or maybe it's twice as large. You look at a Mercator projection, Greenland looks almost as big as Africa. But how much bigger is Africa than Greenland? It's 14 times bigger. Greenland is tiny. You could fit 14 Greenlands into one Africa. Which is bigger, South America or Europe? If you look at a map, Europe looks bigger, but South America is twice as large. So that's one of the problems of these projections. So it distorts the area, the shape that you're looking at, and the world looks dramatically different. Now, there's one kind of projection that you can do that prevents a lot of these distortions, but you get kind of a weird-looking map. One of these is called the Boggs Eumorphic. How does the Boggs Eumorphic work? Well, imagine that you take the balloon, or let's take an orange. You take an orange, you draw the Earth on it, and you peel the orange. When you lay the orange pieces out, you can lay them out in a way where they don't touch one another, they don't connect. And if you lay them out and just imagine there's a blank space between the oranges, you can actually see the world there. So sometimes you see those maps where it looks like there's like three or four cutouts of a map all put next to each other, but they don't connect into one shape like a rectangle or a circle. That's a Boggs eumorphic projection named after, I think it's Samuel Boggs, and eumorphic just means good shape. So it's presented, it has a bunch of interruptions, so it's not the most pleasing map to look at, but it's one of the most accurate. Now, the Mercator projection, aside from its inaccuracy, Arno Peters was a cartographer, or at least a layman interested in cartography, who he was incensed about the Mercator projection, and he believed actually that it was racist, that the projection made the northern hemisphere look larger and more important than the southern hemisphere. And so he believed that a map should be created that more accurately represented the size of countries, because he felt like South America and Africa were being marginalized by making those continents smaller than they really are. You make their political influence smaller, and it's a kind of imperialism or kind of racism. Here's an interview with him from a long time ago where he was talking about that.
The size is the first sign of the importance of a country. The base of my world history is the fairness to all peoples. But this map, what they asked me, what map to? Ah, you have the Mercator. Yes, I could give you some maps where this mistake is not as big. And they gave me some other maps, Van der Grinden or Winkel and so on. And I said, no, I want a map where the sizes are exactly the same as in reality.
And so he ended up working with someone else, a gentleman named Gall, to develop the Gall-Peters map. And so the Gall-Peters map actually stretches out South America and Africa more to make them larger than what you normally see. And it's supposed to correct the distortions you'd see in a Mercator projection. And a few years ago, here's an article about this on insider.com. Children at schools in Boston would have found an unfamiliar map of the world in their classrooms. City authorities decided it would be best to introduce the Gall-Peters map of the Earth to schools because it shows the size of countries more accurately. And if you look at a Gall-Peters versus a Mercator, it looks like, hey, who stretched the Mercator projection? It looks like someone literally kind of stretched it out. And Africa is actually in the center of the projection. It takes a place of prominence, and North America and Asia kind of begin to fade away in the background. It's almost like a very Afrocentric kind of map. And so the Boston authorities thought, in an era of alternative facts, you remember that a few years ago, people were debating alternative facts, and an attempt to decolonize the curriculum, they went with the Gall-Peters map. However, while some see the change as a victory against fake news, not everyone is thrilled with the decision. The Gall-Peters map shows the correct size of countries, but it also distorts them. Countries are stretched horizontally near the poles and vertically near the equator, so although the size may be right, the shape definitely isn't. So there's the problem right there, that any map you use, any two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional Earth is going to be distorted. So Gall-Peters, maybe he got the size right, but the shapes of the countries are all messed up now. Whereas the Mercator projection, you get the shapes and the distances right, but the sizes get messed up as a result of the ratios between different points on the map. So that is the debate among cartographers between Mercator, Peters, and do your, I mean, it's fun. You can go to Wikipedia, all different kinds of map projections out there. But the lesson to be learned is the most reliable map you can find of the world is a globe. Efficient, you know, get yourself a globe. You won't be disappointed. Next, about maps. Have you ever heard that on older maps, there used to be representations of dragons? Like, here's the ocean and the new world, or here's the ocean and beyond the ocean we've explored. We don't know what's there. So the cartographers would draw a little dragon in the ocean and say, here be dragons. And actually, there's not a lot of evidence that that was done. There's only two cases where that's used. If you go back in history, one of the oldest maps, the Borgia map, is in the Vatican Library. It has a dragon-like figure in Asia, not in the waters off of Europe. And it says here there are, and so a lot of ancient maps had mythological figures in different areas to talk about not just the region, but the unknown dangers that awaited travelers who went there. So in the Borgia map, it says in Asia, here there are even men who have large 4-foot horns, and there are even serpents so large that they could eat an ox whole. Now, I doubt there were men with 4-foot horns. There could have been men with decorative helmets that looked like horns. And the snake that can eat an ox, well, there are some anacondas that grow to 20, 25 feet. So it could be talking about anacondas in Asia or other large snakes like that. That it's not that far off. It says there are just two known historical uses of the Latin phrase hic sunt dracones, here are dragons or here be dragons. One is on the Hunt Lennox globe, on which the term appeared at the southeast coast of Asia. So once again, not in the waters in the Atlantic Ocean, it's over Asia. And this might be related to the Komodo dragons of the Indonesian islands. The other appearance of the term, also on the southeast coast of Asia, is on a globe engraved on two conjoined halves of ostrich eggs. So they're not sure if it refers to a mythical or a real creature. But the idea of putting these kinds of fanciful figures on maps was something that was commented on even a very long time ago, about 1900 years ago, the ancient Roman historian Plutarch. This is what he said about geographers of his time who would put mythical creatures on maps. He says, as geographers, socius, crowd into the edges of their maps parts of the world which they do not know about, adding notes in the margin to the effect that beyond this lies nothing but sandy deserts full of wild beasts, unapproachable bogs, Scythian ice, or a frozen sea. So in this work of mine, Plutarch wrote A Wonderful Lives, The History of the Roman Caesars, and I think he also dabbled in cartography, he didn't dabble in cartography, but he's talking about his lives, in which I have compared the lives of the greatest men with one another, after passing through those periods which probable reasoning can reach to and real history find a footing in, I might very well say of those that are farther off, beyond this there is nothing but prodigies and fictions. So what he's saying here is that he's trying to do history, and he knows people of his time who are doing geography. And people who do geography, they know the world around them, but the further you get away, there's monsters and beasts and bogs and frozen lakes and places you don't even want to go because I don't know what's there. And so what Plutarch says is, I wrote history of people in my time, but the further I get away from my time, I might as well say, there is nothing but prodigies and fictions. The only inhabitants are the poets and inventors of fables. There is no credit or certainty any farther. And so just as the geographer stretches when he gets to the edge of the map and he has to do a lot of speculation there, the historian kind of stretches as he gets further and further away from history, especially when you get to before the written word, prehistory, before the written word 5,000 years ago on cuneiform tablets in Sumeria. You had, you know, traditions, maybe cave drawings, maybe artifacts. There's a lot of speculation. Anthropologists like to say that if they find an artifact at a site of human civilization and they don't know what it meant, they just say, it has a ritual significance, which can explain anything, and in doing so, it actually explains nothing. Next, in many of the maps you look at, not just on the projection being incorrect, there are deliberate lies in the maps, and for good reasons. There are cartographic errors that some map makers, in fact, many map makers, specifically put fictional towns and streets in their maps for particular reasons. Now, one reason could just be sheer vandalism and being cheeky. So, for example, on a map of Colorado back in the 1970s, there was Mount Richard on a lot of maps for Colorado, a fictitious peak on the Rocky Mountains Continental Divide that appeared on a Boulder County, Colorado map in the early 1970s. It is believed to be the work of draftsman Richard Chiacci, and the fiction was not discovered until 2 years later. So Richard Chiacci was making a map of the Rocky Mountains, and he decided on his map to put Mount Richard, to name it there, or to label a Mount Richard, even though no such mountain actually existed. However, there are other cases where map makers, what they will do is they'll put a fake, they don't do it just for vandalism, they do it for a very specific reason, to prevent for copyright infringement. They'll put a fake street or a fake town on the map, and that way if they see somebody is selling a map and they say they recognize the fake town or fake street on that map, they can say, hey, you copied my map, you owe me compensation for this. You stole my work. Because otherwise, you know, it's easy to say somebody stole a piece of fiction. You just compare it. But the idea is that if everybody's making maps, they should all look the same because the world is the same. So to show that a map is unique and to show when someone's copied from it, you put a fake town or a fake street that doesn't really exist. And there's a great video on YouTube that actually talks more about this and shares a good story. It's on Jay Foreman's channel. I'll play a little bit of that for you right now.
In 1936, Esso created a fake town called Agloe on this empty spot on their map of New York State.
But then, in the 1950s, a shop was built on that spot, and the owners, looking at the Esso map, decided to call it the Agloe General Store.
Years later, another map company called Rand McNally tried to copy Esso's map, and then Esso tried to sue them. But the joke was on Esso because, thanks to the general store, Agloe had now become a real place, and the case was thrown out.
So there you have something interesting with Agloe. Agloe is a famous fake town in New York, as this video talks about, where Esso made a map of it. It was a fake town they put in, but then they built Agloe's general store. Agloe became a real town, so when Rand McNally copied Esso, they couldn't win the case because Esso had become real. So there's a case of life imitating art. So you can go online and look up fictional places. Trap streets is another name of this. So if you look up a trap street, it's a street that doesn't really exist. And so it's a way to trap people who are trying to pirate different elements on maps. And if you call map makers and say, are there any fake, if you ask a map maker, is there any fake city or street on your map? They'll say no. So what are you, you know, what are you going to do there? And this may have been the case in 2008 with Google. So Google, and these are also called fake, so they're trap streets. They're also called paper towns. And so Google apparently had a paper town that was discovered in 2008 called Argleton, England. It was discovered on Google Maps and Google Earth, but the location of Argleton, England wasn't a town. It's just empty land. People were intrigued, and someone even registered the domain argleton.com and wrote, "What the hell are they talking about? We, the good citizens of Argleton, do exist. Here we are now." Argleton has since disappeared, and Google never actually admitted that it was a copyright trap. A spokesperson for the company said, "While the vast majority of this information is correct, there are occasional errors. We're constantly working to improve the quality and accuracy of the information available in Google Maps." So when you look at Google Maps or other maps, they won't admit there's errors there, but they're purposely put there in the maps to thwart copyright violators. Here's the next interesting bit of trivia about maps. In World War II, the United States playing card company, you know, the guys who make bicycle playing cards, you know, play poker, things like that, probably the most common card deck in the U.S., they made secret maps for prisoners of war. So here's how it would happen. This map, created by the U.S. playing card company, the deck was specifically created to help Allied prisoners of war escape from German POW camps. This deck of cards became known as the map deck. It was made by hiding maps of top secret escape routes between the two paper layers that make up all modern playing cards. When soaked in water, these decks could be peeled apart to reveal hidden maps that allowed escaping prisoners to find their way to safety. Due to the nature of the war and the prosecution of war crimes thereafter, the map decks remained a closely guarded secret for many years after the war ended. The secrecy surrounding them was so high that no one really knows how many were produced or how many have survived. And so that's amazing there that you can imagine if you're a prisoner of war, if you've been a paratrooper or infantryman, you've been captured behind German enemy lines, you're put in a POW camp, and they'll probably, you know, you take your guns, you're going to take your papers, your documents, but they may be nice to you and let you keep your cards. You know, have some playing cards, play your cards, whatever, don't bother me. And then, of course, but hidden in the card, each card in the middle of the card as you tore it away was a map to be able to find your way to safety if you were able to escape. Here's the next one. Is an article on CNN talking about how Google makes maps, not just to see what it looks like top up, but if you look on Google, you can go to Street View. I love Street View. You can find all kinds of weird stuff on Street View, too. So go to YouTube, search weird Google Street View stuff, and all kinds of interesting things come up. Like, I feel bad for the people that walk out in like their bathrobe or their underwear on their front porch when the Google Street View car goes by. And so there's all kinds of, there was a case actually just a year or two ago where a woman or man, they had been vanished, missing for like 10 years. And Google satellite images showed their car at the bottom of a retention pond. The sun was shining just right on the water to reveal it, but nobody saw it until then. But you could see it on Google Earth if you looked at it from directly above, and they located the car and this poor person's body. But the mystery was solved. So Google does a lot of Street View, and they have one where they take robot car. You know, normally they'll do cars. You'll see that. But according to this article, you know, instead of using cars or internet-enabled glasses, Google hired a camel. The beast has become the first animal to carry Google's Trekker camera, which is typically hoisted by humans to... Okay, normally I would seamlessly edit in the rest of the quotation I was reading from you in case there was an error or problem, but I'm not going to do that this time because at that very last word that got cut off there, that was when the power went out yesterday. So I was in my office, I was recording here at Catholic Answers, and then the power goes out, and I record this episode in my office using a mixing board, and the mixing board needs to run power, and when it goes out, it's saved, fortunately, in my little audio recorder, what I had recorded up to that point, but I couldn't put anything else on. And so I just went out in the office, and it was all dark. I'm like, this is weird. Are we under attack or something? So I called Laura, make sure she was fine. It was just our building. Then I found most of the staff in the conference room having a taco lunch because they invited Dr. John Cuddeback from Christendom to visit us. And I go in there, and what's funny is the conference room doesn't have windows either, but everyone had just turned on the light, the flashlight on their cell phones, and then was able to illuminate the whole conference room. And then I left because without power, without internet, I can't really do anything. So I left the office, and then finally the power was restored later in the day, but not till much later, and then now I am here finishing the episode. And so long story short, I forget where I was, but Google is using camels with cameras attached to them to get those wonderful street image views of the Liwa Oasis in Abu Dhabi. So, you know, if you ever want to, you know, take a camel around for Google, maybe you should send in an application. All right. Last thing when I'm talking about maps, there is a bit from one of my favorite comedians, Brian Regan, and he's talking about the television show Dora the Explorer. I'm saying it wrong because first he makes a keen observation that Dora the Explorer, it doesn't really rhyme. Let's put on Dora the Explorer. He said it only rhymes like in the Kennedy household. Hey there, turn on Dora the Explorer. Like if you're a Kennedy, it rhymes. But there's a song in Dora the Explorer called I Am the Map, I Am the Map. And so since we're talking about maps, I got to get Brian Ringed's comments on the song from Dora the Explorer, the I'm the Map song. So here we go.
Other than there's a song in Dora the Explorer that absolutely amazes me. And I wish I had been at the pitch meeting where it was approved. So did you get a chance to work on a song? Yeah, well, I remember now. Yeah, we're working on one. Don't worry about it. Why don't you go ahead and sing it for us then? Yeah, okay. Sure, if you want that now. All right, here we go. I'm the map, 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 I'm the map! I like that twist at the end. It is the map.
So, there you go to round out our Free for All Friday. Thank you so much, everyone, for being able to stop by the Council of Trent podcast. Please consider leaving a review at iTunes or Google Play. I think we're close to 900 reviews now. If we could get to 1,000 on iTunes or Google Play, I would really appreciate it, and I think it helps to benefit people so they understand more about the podcast and see it's worth their time. You should also check out the podcast at YouTube. Just search Council of Trent on YouTube. I think it finally comes up now. We're near or past 1,000 subscribers there on YouTube. We're getting in the YouTube game. And then, of course, consider supporting us at TrenthornPodcast.com. You get access to bonus content and the ability to submit questions for future episodes, sneak peeks for upcoming dialogues, lots of great stuff there. Be sure to go and check us out at TrenthornPodcast.com. You guys have been awesome, and I hope that you have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.